KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
As soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel.
This hour, we look at President Trump's record so far as he wades into three military conflicts.
It's Tuesday, June 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, our co-host Juana Summers continues her conversation with Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska about her new memoir.
How we in Congress stand up for our delegated powers under the Constitution, that's what we need to be focused on.
Also, a lot of brides are discovering that tariffs are making those wedding dresses pricier now.
The last thing that I want to do as someone has fallen in love with themselves in a gown is to start talking about global trade policy.
And ancient Roman frescoes unearthed in the heart of London.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is at the NATO summit in The Hague and attended a dinner with leaders of the North Atlantic Alliance and Queen Maxima of the Netherlands. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the NATO allies will get down to serious business Wednesday.
European Commission head Ursula von der Leyen said the Europe of defense had finally awoken.
Tomorrow the summit will set indeed historic new spending targets for NATO allies.
The 32 member nations are set to commit 5% of their gross national product toward defense spending, raising it from the current 2%. Von der Leyen says the boost is necessary to confront a newly aggressive Russia.
We know that Russia will be capable of testing our mutual defense commitments within the next 5 years. By 2030, Europe must have everything it needs for credible deterrence.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and President Trump's threats to leave NATO unless the Europeans paid, quote, their fair share, has jolted alliance members into action. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, The Hague.
A U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly has confirmed a CNN report that based on an early assessment, the massive U.S. air campaign against Iran this past weekend did not obliterate Iran's nuclear program, as the Trump administration has claimed, but instead set it back a few months. Senators were slated to get a classified briefing today, but that's now been moved to Thursday. Meanwhile, a somewhat tenuous ceasefire between Iran and Israel appears to be holding. A man charged in connection to the bombing of a fertility clinic in Palm Springs, California, has died in federal custody. Member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Ament reports Daniel Park was in prison for supplying large amounts of chemicals used in the attack.
Park was charged earlier this month for allegedly mailing some 270 pounds of ammonium nitrate to the FBI's main suspect in the bombing, Guy Edward Bark case. Bark has detonated a car bomb outside the clinic that was felt for blocks. He was the only person that died in what federal prosecutors called a suicidal terror attack. The FBI has not said how Park and Bartkus knew each other, but have said they shared a fringe ideology called pro-mortalism, the belief that people should not exist. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has not said how Park died. Their statement said Park was found unresponsive in his cell at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles and declared dead at a hospital. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament.
New York City voters are going to the polls today deciding whether Andrew Cuomo's done enough to make a political comeback. Former governor hoping to reboot his career after being forced to resign amid allegations of sexual harassment. Cuomo faces a number of candidates in the city's primary, including liberal opponent 33-year-old Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist who's been courting the youth vote. Current Mayor Eric Adams is running as an independent in the fall general election. You're listening to NPR. Singer and actor Bobby Sherman, a teen idol in the 1960s and 70s, has died. He was 81. Actor John Stamos shared a post on Instagram with a statement from Sherman's wife, who said her husband had stage 4 cancer. NPR's Mandalito Barco has this remembrance.
More than 50 years ago, many teens had a crush on the easygoing pop star Bobby Sherman. He was often featured in the popular Tiger Beat magazine, and his songs climbed the Billboard music charts. Come on now. In 1969, Sherman scored a hit with Little Woman, and later Easy Come, Easy Go, and Julie, Do You Love Me? Performed on variety TV shows like Shindig and acted on the TV series Here Comes the Brides.
What's this all about?
I don't know. I just got here myself.
Sherman also acted on The Mod Squad, Fantasy Island, and later Frasier. After showbiz, Sherman became a reserve officer and an emergency medical trainer for the Los Angeles Police Department. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
After having its entire population decimated by the bird flu, the last commercial duck farm on Long Island is back in business. The Crescent Duck Farm was forced to destroy its entire 100,000 bird flock in January, but has now received an initial batch of about 900 young ducks last month, with more arriving. Long Island at one time was at the center of the U.S. duck production business, with more than 100 farms. Crude oil futures prices fell sharply today, reaching a two-week low amid expectations a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran may not hold. Oil down $4 a barrel. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran appears to be holding, at least for now. President Trump is claiming credit and has billed himself as a peacemaker since re-entering office in January. Over the past 5 months, Trump has become directly involved in three separate conflicts, but so far, his record is mixed at best. To explain, we're joined now by NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, I feel like so much has happened in even the last 24 hours. What is the current status on the Israel-Iran ceasefire?
Well, it's holding, though it really doesn't feel very solid or secure yet. Trump raged at both Israel and Iran this morning, saying they were both shooting after the deal took effect. And Trump, as we know, is a very strong supporter of Israel, so his sharp criticism was striking.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I'd never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel.
So most shooting over the past 12 days has been at night. It's now early Wednesday morning in both countries, so this will be the first big test of whether it's working. And Elsa, at this point, I feel compelled to quote Mark Twain, who said, "Giving up smoking is the easiest thing in the world. I know because I've done it thousands of times." Ugh. Well, the same thing is true with Mideast ceasefires. Yeah. They're easy to declare. It's been done countless times. The hard part is making them stick, and that's precisely where we are right now.
That quote is so apt. Okay, but do we actually know how much damage has been done to Iran's nuclear program?
Well, at this point, we don't know for sure, and it's already shaping up to be a major point of contention. Trump said U.S. airstrikes totally obliterated the nuclear facilities. He angrily denounced the media today for questioning his position. But members of the national security community are offering assessments that are at least somewhat at odds with the president. One U.S. official, speaking on condition of anonymity, tells our NPR colleague Tom Bowman that the Defense Intelligence Agency believes the damage was limited at Iran's most important nuclear site, Fordo, and Iran's program has probably been set back a few months. Now, we should add that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, said Sunday at a Pentagon news conference that the Iranian sites sustained extremely severe damage, but a full assessment was still ongoing.
Okay, so some competing claims in the U.S., but how do you think Israel and Iran are likely to characterize the war?
So Israel can say it greatly weakened Iran, its biggest rival in the region, and Iran can say it withstood a double-barrel attack from the U.S. and Israel and is still standing. So they could both claim some sort of success, though it's less than a full victory for Israel, and Iran has suffered another in a series of recent setbacks.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's turn to another war in the Middle East. Israel and Hamas in Gaza. What's the picture there right now?
Yeah, you know, this conflict has really been ignored the past couple of weeks, but more than 40 Palestinian civilians were killed in Israeli strikes today. That's according to Palestinian officials. The humanitarian crisis remains dire. And a reminder, Israel and Hamas had a ceasefire on January 19th, the day before Trump was inaugurated. He claimed credit for that truce, just as he's done in Iran, saying it wouldn't have happened without him. But the ceasefire collapsed with an Israeli offensive in March. Trump has not sought to restrain the Israelis in Gaza, and that war grinds on under conditions worse than the day he took office.
Mm-hmm. All right, to Europe now. The president has also tried to broker peace in the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. How is that effort going?
Yeah, Elsa, Trump just arrived in the Netherlands for a NATO summit where this war will feature prominently. Trump may meet Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky there. In short, the fighting has intensified recently, mostly because Russia has ramped up missile and drone strikes. And Trump runs hot and cold on this war, at times saying a ceasefire is near, then backing away and saying the two sides just might have to fight it out.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Elsa.
War broke out in the Middle East, but unlike in decades past, there has not been panic about a subsequent oil crisis. NPR's Camila Domonoske is here to explain why.
Immediately after Israel attacked Iran, crude prices did shoot up, but only by about 7% over a few hours.
We saw a lot of people kind of react to that, saying, why isn't crude reacting more? This is a real risk.
That's Rebecca Bobbin, a senior energy trader at CIBC Private Wealth. She says traders like her responded conservatively, in part because of recent experience with Ukraine, Gaza, other attacks.
Throughout all the other geopolitical events that have happened over the last several years, we get these spikes and then supply is not impacted and they revert very quickly.
And that's exactly what happened again. Prices were volatile, but the spike was short-lived. And that was partly because of the specifics of this conflict. Once again, supply wasn't impacted because oil wasn't targeted. It kept flowing. But there's also some global factors behind the quick recovery. Angie Gilday is U.S. energy lead for the accounting giant KPMG.
You know, we are in a period of time right now within the energy markets where we have a bit of an oversupply.
The world just has too much oil. Supply is growing faster than demand. We're making more than we need. Then there's a big overarching geopolitical transformation. The shale revolution in the United States has lessened the world's dependence on Mideast crude. Over a decade ago, new technology like fracking unlocked American oil fields. Jim Burkhard leads crude oil market research at S&P Global.
The U.S. is the biggest oil producer in the world by far. The impact on the oil market is profound.
The U.S. makes a lot of oil and could make even more. So the U.S. is less reliant on the Middle East, and the rest of the world has backup supplies if it needs them. But of course, right now the world doesn't need more oil. Quite the opposite. So while this week President Trump repeated his call to drill, baby, drill, Burkhard says,
we think, we've been saying for the last few months, we think U.S. oil production is going to decline.
Because the market is telling companies to drill less. To chill, baby, chill. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
How much extra would you pay to see your dream become reality? It's always a big question for couples planning their weddings. And these days, it has a new twist, courtesy of tariffs. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Helping a bride pick her wedding dress can be a pretty intimate process for the seller.
Helping them get in and out of gowns, talking about money, talking about emotions, talking about body image issues.
Christine Greenberg has been doing this for 11 years as a co-owner of Urban Set Bride, a boutique in Richmond, Virginia.
So the last thing that I want to do as someone has fallen in love with themselves in a gown and everyone is crying and we're having this moment is to start talking about politics and global trade policy.
But lately, tariffs have entered even the bridal fitting room, as couples are discovering that almost all the dresses are made abroad. Many are designed in the U.S. and made in China. The National Bridal Retailers Association says China accounts for a whopping 90% of the bridal gown market. One of those gowns, with a sweetheart neckline and a long tail, now belongs to a Boston bride, Jessica Kaplan.
When I showed up, they were like, we just want to let you know that due to the tariffs that are occurring, there is a surcharge on most wedding dresses that are coming in, anywhere between 10 to 15%. So we did have to pay a $150 surcharge on it. It wasn't detrimental, but it was definitely a bummer on the day a bit.
For a while, the Trump administration added a new tariff of 145% on Chinese imports. Now it's temporarily reduced to 30% until July 9. The two countries are negotiating, and American store owners have no idea how to budget this year.
By and large, wedding gowns are special order.
Claire Landgraf runs Finery Bridal Chic, a boutique in Rochester, Minnesota. She says when someone buys a dress from her store,
their gown doesn't come in for 6 to 8 months. So what's the landscape of tariff charging going to look like in 6 to 8 months? We don't know.
Many designers and stores have simply raised prices across the board to cover new tariff expenses. It's not just gowns coming from China, but also embellishments, trims, crystals, veils and hair pieces, hangers and garment bags. Landgraf, for now, is charging brides half her tariff cost per gown as a line item that she can remove if tariffs are gone when it arrives. All this has more brides hesitating to say yes to the dress.
This has been one of the slowest seasons.
In terms of people buying the gowns, she says since COVID, when parties were risky, brides are coming in, but they used to visit once or twice before buying, and now
I am seeing a lot more multiple visit brides.
Some of the most popular U.S. gown makers, Maggie Sotero, based in Utah, Allure, based in Tennessee, have urged the federal government to exempt formal wear from tariffs, because American textile manufacturing faded out decades ago.
My dad was in the Army for 24 years. I would love to purchase American-made wedding gowns.
That's Virginia store owner Christine Greenberg again.
But they don't really exist. They certainly don't exist at the price point that the average American consumer could purchase a wedding gown.
An average bride, not in a big city, spends under $2,000 on a wedding gown. American-made dresses tend to start around twice that price. And not only are there few people buying them, there are very few people making them. Skilled technicians of lace work, embroidery, beading by hand. Growing this on a mass scale would take many years.
You know, I'm kind of curious about what if I get like a dressmaker?
Chelsea Ritchie is another tariff season bride in Los Angeles who's trying to face the new reality by thinking outside the box.
You know, buy the materials and I buy the fabric and see if somebody can make me a dress within the same price versus me ordering it and then altering it.
Her dream dress is dazzling white with a mermaid silhouette. It's likely her fabric and materials would still be imported. Another decision to make, another thing to stress about during the joys of wedding planning. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Republican Lisa Murkowski wrote in her new memoir that she didn't desire a career in politics. And yet, the senator from Alaska has often found herself in the political spotlight. First, when her father controversially appointed her to fill his Senate seat when he became governor in 2002. Later, as an elected senator who gained a reputation for bucking her party and at times sharply criticizing the Trump administration on key issues.
I do not seek opportunities to poke a finger in President Trump's eye or anybody's eye. That's not who I am. That's not my style. But I am one who, when I see something that needs to be called out, I will call it out if it needs to be.
I sat down with Senator Murkowski yesterday in New York to discuss a range of issues that concern her, as well as her path to serving more than two decades in the Senate. Something you talk about in great detail in your book is the number of times that you were on the opposite side of your party on key votes and went your own way. For example, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And it seems like you were in that position again with President Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill. What do you think that the American people should understand about what is currently in that bill and why you're not on board at this point?
Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on this because it is a bill that has come out of the Congress, not necessarily from the administration. So you're calling it his bill. He has clearly named it.
The Big Beautiful Bill, as he likes to say.
I don't refer to it as the Big Beautiful Bill. It is big, and I'm not quite sure it's beautiful yet. There is much in it, quite honestly, that I really like. I'm pleased with the increased funding that's in the reconciliation bill for Coast Guard. There are many aspects contained in the bill that I think are going to be important from a border perspective, from a defense perspective, and from an energy perspective. But having said that, where's the bulk of the attention right now? It's on Medicaid. So Medicaid is very important to so many in our state. None of our entitlement programs are entirely perfect. We can always do more when it comes to oversight and areas of reform. But I want to make sure that it works for those who are in greatest need. I still have some reservations about the SNAP provisions. This is the nutrition programs for needy families with work requirements that may not be attainable, not because people don't want to work, but because you come from an area in my state of Alaska. There are so many areas in rural Alaska where there are very, very, very few jobs.
And I'll ask you about just one other piece of legislation, which is the rescission package, which would take back $9.4 billion that were already appropriated for foreign aid, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'll just note that about $1 billion of that funding goes to CPB, which sends much of it to local stations that carry PBS and NPR programming. I know that you're on the Senate Appropriations Committee that's going to hold a hearing on this package this week. What's your view of this bill?
I am an unabashed supporter of public broadcasting. In my state that is so highly rural, it is the benefits of public broadcasting that allows people to not only get their news, but to communicate with one another, to be given alerts as to storms and what is happening with tides and landslides and the fishing report. So for me, I am looking at this and saying the threat to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is very real with this rescission, and it's not something that I support. Likewise, within some of the global health programs, we have seen the benefit. One of the ways that we are able to help in many ways avoid conflict is through humanitarian efforts that our nation is engaged in. And I think we need to make sure that everybody remembers that ultimately it is the Congress that has the power of the purse, has the power to determine those appropriations.
if I remember correctly, you have never voted for President Trump. Is that right?
Correct.
And yet today, you're a member of a political party that has been largely defined by the president, his MAGA movement. I wonder, do you feel like there is still a place for moderates within the Republican Party, for people like you?
I think there is still a place in the Congress for moderates. We need more on the Republican side. We need more on the Democrat side. But you talk to most people in Alaska today, hopefully the majority in America today, they're going to say, why aren't they just solving some problems? Why does everything have to be so political? But that's kind of where we've been pushed. And the only way that we're going to be able to get away from that is if we push back.
Well, let me ask you this, because you make it clear in the book that you were quite concerned about the way that people see our institutions. What role should you and your fellow lawmakers play in restoring that credibility and integrity for people who don't feel like it's working for them?
Well, it's a great question, because we can't control everything, right? I'm one out of 100 people say, oh, you got a lot of stroke here. I can't necessarily fix the judiciary. I can't necessarily fix the executive, but I do have a place in the legislative branch. And so how we in Congress stand up for our own authorities, our delegated powers under the Constitution, under Article 1, that's what we need to be focused on. You can be a 100% Trump supporter and still stand up for Congress's authority. They are not mutually exclusive.
A broad question for you. Do you think that the country's democracy is on unstable footing?
You know, I mentioned I've been in the Senate now for two decades, long time. I've never been part of more conversations where people have asked whether or not, whether democracy is safe right now. It is not something that I would say, oh, you know, it's all over. Absolutely, positively not. But do we need to guard these fundamentals, guard these values with great jealousy and ensure that they survive? Absolutely. But it takes work.
I'll end on this note. Those people that you're talking about who may feel right now like it's time to check out, like they aren't engaged with the process for one reason or another. What is your message to people who right now feel like they don't have a political home?
Don't assume that anybody else is going to speak up for you. You know, I've never been to a protest as a protester, right? What we saw weekend before last with marches around the country, where people were speaking up in some of the smallest villages in Alaska, I think that that's some of the best part of who we are. Do it peaceably, do it without violence, but speak up.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, thank you so much for coming and spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Murkowski's new memoir, Far From Home, An Alaskan Senator Faces the Extreme Climate of Washington, D.C., is out now. And you can hear and watch more of this conversation at NPR.org.
This is NPR News.
Who is the supreme leader who guides Iran?
He actually has much more control than an American president in the sense that he also has control over the media. He has control over the judiciary, the legislature.
And what did Ayatollah Ali Khamenei reveal with his response to a U.S. attack? The latest on the Mideast war tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It's been 3 years since the constitutional right to an abortion was overturned.
Now an increasing number of women are turning to self-managed abortions, a practice some doctors support.
I'm practicing evidence-based medicine that is the leading edge of what reproductive health care might look like.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump is meeting with NATO leaders in the Netherlands for a two-day summit. Trump is pushing military alliance members to increase spending on security from 2 to 5% of their gross domestic product. NATO Security General Mark Rutte praised the president for making Europe, quote, pay in a big way on defense.
There is total commitment by the U.S. president and the U.S. senior leadership to NATO. However, it comes with an expectation. And the expectation is that we will finally deal with this huge pebble in the shoe, this huge irritant, which is that we are not spending enough as Europeans and Canadians. And they want us to equalize with what the U.S. is spending.
NATO allies are expected to endorse the goal of spending 5% of their GDP on defense, but Rutte says no one expects every country to commit to that goal. Spain says it won't reach the target, and others are doubtful. The State Department has published new rules that set the stage for layoffs expected later this week. NPR's Michelle Kellerman tells us the employees' union says the changes will weaken America's ability to conduct foreign policy.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is streamlining the State Department, cutting offices and personnel. His aides have updated the rules to make it easier to fire career Foreign Service officers who are currently on assignment in offices that he's closing. The American Foreign Service Association, the State Department's union, denounced the move, saying it allows the department to, quote, purge an entire domestic office while giving lip service to factors such as employee evaluations, veteran status, and language ability. AFSA says a reduction in force should be a measure of last resort. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Stocks were up on Wall Street today after oil prices eased on hopes Israel's war with Iran won't damage global crude. This is NPR. More than half a century ago, the World Health Organization launched a program to get more children immunized for diseases such as polio. NPR's Gabrielle Emmanuel has this update.
The study published in The Lancet found that childhood vaccination rates have increased dramatically in the last 50 years, but
progress has really stalled since about 2010.
That's Jonathan Moser. He's one of the study authors and a professor at Washington University. He says some countries have even seen a drop in their vaccination rates. For example, 100 of the 200 plus countries researchers looked at saw a decline in measles vaccination rates. Others saw drops in diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis.
There are challenges related to conflict. There are challenges related to supply chains and challenges associated with vaccine misinformation as well.
The U.S. has also cut funding for some global vaccination efforts. Gabriella Emmanuel, NPR News.
Some truckers are fearing job loss as new English language rules from the Trump administration go into effect. President Trump signed an executive order in April saying that commercial truckers who don't read and speak English proficiently would be considered unfit for service. The new rules call for enhanced roadside inspections to decide if truckers can reply to questions and directions in English. Some are worried if they make a mistake or speak with a heavy accent, they'll be fired. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. and from Total Wine and More for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Since the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear facilities over the weekend, one key question has been, did it work? Did the American attacks end Iran's nuclear program? President Trump insisted Saturday evening the attack was, quote, a spectacular military success.
Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
Well, now, according to a U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly, an early intelligence assessment says the damage was far less than the president claimed, and Iran's nuclear program was set back only a few months, with limited damage to centrifuges at Iran's Fordo facility. Virginia Senator Mark Warner is the leading Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he is here to tell us what he has seen. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Well, thank you, Ari.
You've read the intelligence assessment. What have you learned?
Well, I am not going to talk about what I've seen in classified intelligence. I'm a little old-fashioned that way. But I have a whole lot of questions for this administration. I really am very disappointed they canceled the briefing that the senators deserved today. They've moved it to Thursday. But if you just look over the last 12 or 13 days, when Israel first launched the attack, the administration's position was, well, we would help defend Israel, as we should, but we are not going to be involved. Then the American intelligence communities reiterated a week ago Monday that Iran had not made a decision to move towards a weapon. Then the administration went ahead and launched their attack, but they were saying at one point, they were only going against the Iranian nuclear facilities and no regime change, and the president said regime change, now he's back.
I hear you say the goalposts are moving, but I'm curious just what how you would answer the question, was the attack successful?
I'm going to wait to hear the administration's explanation, but I have more questions than I had even before the initial assessment. And again, it's been in the public domain that there were large numbers of questions before any of this took place, whether these bunker buster bombs alone could take out the facilities. There's also very legitimate questions of whether the Iranians moved any of their enriched uranium out of those facilities.
Does the U.S. know where that enriched uranium is? The Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has about 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which, as you say, could have been easily moved.
It has been widely reported and non-classified that you could literally move that in about 10 carloads. I have not seen any indication that we know where all of that is at this moment in time. And let me be clear on it. Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. This is a regime that has been against America, against Israel, been disruptive in the region. But there are reasons why previous presidents, including President Trump in his first term, didn't take these actions, because there are a lot of what next. I mean, are our troops fully safe at this point? Will there not be a third party or surrogates like Hezbollah or the Shia militias? Has Iran agreed not to attack us on a cyber basis? And again, as we've all said, it's a lot easier to start a conflict in the Middle East than it is to end one.
Political appointees in the Trump administration have tried before to pressure intelligence agencies to change their conclusions. We saw that with intel about the Venezuelan Tren de Aragua gang. How confident are you that the conclusions of the intelligence community on this, on the Iran attack, will be free of political interference?
I believe they are so far, and that's why I want to hear what they're going to say on Thursday. Again, I would remind you, the intelligence community said literally 8 days ago that Iran had not decided to move forward with the weaponization. It appears President Trump rejected that. Does that mean he's rejecting the conclusion? Is he accepting the intelligence from Israel? And what does that say if he's taking another country's intelligence over ours? And you're right. I am hugely concerned, as we saw where intelligence professionals were literally fired because they refused to bend the knee and alter intelligence. And we've seen this in the past. That's how we ended up in Iraq, 20-odd years ago.
Well, let me just ask in our last minute, if it is true, as this intelligence report apparently says, that these attacks only set back Iran's nuclear program a few months, where does that leave the U.S. effort to end Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon?
Those are the questions that need to be asked, and those were the questions that we wanted to ask, have answered before he took this action. What next if you don't take them out all in the first strike? What are the next steps? How do we make sure that there's not Iran racing now to a dirty bomb? These are questions that we, and frankly, the American people, deserve answers to.
That is Virginia Senator Mark Warner. He is the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari.
In recent years, excavations in London have revealed incredible archaeological treasures from the Roman Empire, from remnants of roads to handwritten documents nearly 2,000 years old. Now, a dig in the heart of the British capital has unearthed one of the most extensive collections of painted Roman walls or frescoes that's ever been found in the city, as Willem Marx reports.
It was at least 1,800 years ago when colorful fragments from the walls of a high-status Roman building were discarded in a pit during an ancient series of demolitions. Now they've been unearthed at an archaeological site in Southwark, just south of London's River Thames. The person who oversaw their discovery, then the painstaking reconstruction process, is Han Lee, senior building material specialist at the Museum of London Archaeology charity.
There was actually two reactions which, you know, will live with me for the rest of my life. I think the first one, when I realized the initial potential, and that was a feeling of excitement because I had thousands upon thousands of fragments to deal with. But then when you realize that there is actually good potential in good reconstruction, the excitement sort of overwhelms the dread, if you want to put it that way.
With material that filled more than 120 crates, it took months for Lee and his team to reorder the pieces of painted plaster into several massive frescoes, to assemble a jigsaw puzzle on a giant scale.
I remember it was sort of a late night at the office, and I had just put in a really quite crucial piece. And then I looked up, and, you know, there was this beautiful Roman large wall with a corner and a door included, looking right back at me. And it was a moment of silence where I looked at it. It was a beautiful moment to really take it in.
The reborn artworks included motifs of birds, fruit, flowers, and musical instruments known as lyres. But they also included writing with a nearly complete ancient Greek alphabet, the only time such an inscription has been found in Britain. Similar frescoes have been unearthed in modern-day France and Germany, but the artistic influences across the northern reaches of Rome's ancient empire remain little understood. Research into each plaster piece will continue with plans for a future public display. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It was time to celebrate in Oklahoma City today. The Thunder won its first ever NBA championship Sunday night, defeating the Indiana Pacers in a seven-game series. So fans hit the street in a parade, and Robbie Korth with member station KOSU was there. Tough assignment, Robbie.
Yes, Ari.
How was the parade?
It was a very hot parade, but it was a very exciting parade. Just listen to this crowd.
A good day in Oklahoma City. What does this championship mean to people there?
Well, I mean, this has really been a 17-year journey that started when the Oklahoma City Thunder played their first game as the state's only major professional team, and they still are the only one. Since then, fans have honestly been a little spoiled. Their teams have made a bunch of NBA playoff runs, but they were never really able to get over the hump until now. And this was big for fans, and they showed up, lining the streets with kids in tow. I spoke to one fan, this OKC guy named J.K. King. He was there for the Game 7 victory, and he was at the parade handing out mimosas to his fellow fans.
It's incredible for Okies to finally have a top dog. And so to see them make it over the mountaintop in Game 7, it means everything. You know, to see the championship banners here and a bazillion people out here, I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, it's really cool.
We don't typically do crowd counts, but I guess bazillion must be authoritative and accurate. So the fans were pretty hyped. What about the team? They must have been excited too.
Yeah, the team was riding high in double-decker buses, but they all came down on the street, and many of them were not wearing shirts, and they were just high-fiving people, having a good time. Star guard Shai Gilgeous-Alexander even took the Larry O'Brien trophy for the NBA championship to the fans, and he let them touch it. And the fans love him. After all, 26-year-old Gilgeous-Alexander was the first player since 2000 to win regular season MVP, finals MVP, and the scoring title for the most points scored in a season all in the same year, and he was great. But at the parade, he was quick to give credit to his teammates.
So many guys have said it, but this is like family. We do everything together. We need each other out there. We want each other out there. We win because we have each other. We lose because of each other. Probably because of me sometimes. But yeah, we do everything together, and guess what, guys? We won an NBA championship together.
So one little tidbit, this was actually the youngest team to win a title since 1977, and that's decades before any of them were even born. When it came time to pop the champagne in the locker room, their oldest player, and he's only 31, had to show them how to do it.
Aw, so what does the future hold for them?
Well, there's a very bright future. They have a new arena that should begin construction soon. It will be funded by almost $1 billion in public money, and it received overwhelming support and a vote from the people. On the court, national pundits are already making comparisons to past dynasty runs by the Golden State Warriors in the last decade and the Chicago Bulls in the 90s. But for now, people will just take this first ever title, and they enjoyed the parade.
That is Robbie Korth of member station KOSU. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 3 years ago today, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the constitutional right to abortion. Since then, about 40% of U.S. states have increased restrictions on abortions. And now, many women are having abortions without a doctor's oversight. And some doctors are okay with that. Here's reporter Abby Wendell.
For nearly 4 years, Maya Bass's commute included a monthly plane ride from Philadelphia to Oklahoma. Do you like flying?
Oh no, I get really motion sick. I'm really good at not vomiting though, so.
Bass made that trip each month to fill a gap. Oklahoma had a shortage of abortion providers, and she's a family medicine doctor who provides abortion. One way was by prescribing abortion pills. Bass was trained to follow a strict protocol around the pills. It included multiple in-person appointments to get an ultrasound and blood work, and to pick up the pills at the clinic. Bass believed many of these steps kept patients safe.
Of course I'm going to confirm exactly how big this pregnancy is. Of course I'm going to confirm that my patient has enough blood to handle this.
So Bass was concerned when she first heard about self-managed abortion, getting abortion pills without a prescription, and taking them without a doctor's oversight.
Gosh, what if people are dropping like flies because they're taking meds that are actually rat poison and hurting themselves?
A lot of doctors had a similar reaction.
People felt it was really unsafe.
This is Jen Carlin, a professor of family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. In the late 2010s, she became interested in the debate about self-managed abortion.
I wanted to talk with clinicians about this to find out, are you really worried about the safety of this? And if you are, what aspect of the safety are you worried about?
In 2019, Carlin turned these questions into a study. First, she surveyed 40 abortion providers and asked what they thought about self-managed medication abortions. About half of them were ambivalent. Then, Carlin gave them a fact sheet summarizing nearly 24 peer-reviewed studies that showed self-managing with pills is safe and effective.
Like, wait, what? Like, seriously? I never knew about any of this.
Bass was one of the doctors in Carlin's study. The research on that fact sheet showed that the protocol Bass used, the multiple appointments, the ultrasound, wasn't always needed.
Realizing that I was unnecessarily putting people through hoops, that's hard. And then I felt also excited slash maybe relieved. Like, this means that I can be less scared for people who are doing this.
The next year, 2020, far more doctors changed their minds because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need for social distancing.
Now, all of a sudden, the healthcare profession is saying, wait, does that person really need to come in to do that ultrasound? And lo and behold, there's all this evidence already out there that no, they don't.
During the pandemic, the FDA stopped enforcing regulations on one of the abortion pills, mifepristone. Patients were no longer federally required to go to a clinic to get abortion pills. Doctors in many states began using telemedicine. Carlin went back to the doctors she had surveyed in 2019 to see what they thought about medication abortion with less medical oversight.
They're seeing it and they're saying, oh, everything I was reading about in those papers is right, and I'm seeing it from my own eyes, and now I'm even more convinced that it works.
Across the country, many doctors who provide abortions embraced a more demedicalized approach. As of 2024, 19% of all abortions happened with telehealth. But telehealth still requires a doctor to give a patient a prescription. Self-managed abortion goes a step further. People get the pills on their own, often by ordering them online. More women have done just that since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. Since then, studies have shown that the rate of self-managed abortion has increased, and so have online abortion pill orders. And organizations that support people through self-managed abortions have seen an explosion in people reaching out. That's true for the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, which is run by clinicians. Bass, the family medicine doctor, joined the hotline after reading the research about self-managed abortion.
The vast majority of the calls I'm dealing with are people just being like, hey, can you tell me if it worked?
Bass knows self-managed abortions can't replace all abortions. Some people need medical intervention or just prefer to go to a clinic. But to her, the hotline and the immediate access it gives women to doctors without unnecessary tests feels innovative.
It feels like I'm just on the cutting edge of medicine. I'm practicing evidence-based medicine that is the leading edge of what reproductive health care might look like.
The broader mainstream medical community has been moving in this direction, too. In 2022, the World Health Organization declared self-managed abortion to be a safe and effective method in the first trimester. And in 2024, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists put out a statement in support of it. But there's been movement in the opposite direction, too. Last month, Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. ordered the FDA to review regulations on mifepristone, which could restore the rules that require patients to get multiple tests and pick up the pills at a clinic. If abortion pills get harder to access through the formal healthcare system, even more women may look to self-managed abortion.
That was Abby Wendell, reporter for Embedded, NPR's home for long-form documentaries. The podcast just came out with a new series about the history of self-managed abortions called The Network. It was produced with Futuro Media. One of the leading voices of early 1980s R&B, Kevin Yarbrough of the singing duo Yarbrough and Peoples, died this month at the age of 72. His wife confirmed to CBS News.
Yarbrough was a classically trained pianist who played and sang ferociously with his wife, Elisa Peoples. They were discovered by the Gap Band's Charlie Wilson.
Or Uncle Charlie Wilson, as some may know him. With his help, the duo signed to Total Experience Records, where they started making quintessential 80s music.
Like their number one hit, Don't Stop the Music.
Synthesizers, 808 drums, Elisa Peoples' bold yet endearing vocals. This was their recipe, which sounded futuristic then, but is now timeless.
And shaped so much of what the genre would sound like during the 80s.
The duo pioneered other hits like Don't Waste Your Time and Guilty.
I mean, when Don't Stop the Music came out, I mean, come on, we were skating off of that and just, I mean, it was just groundbreaking. And then the video, I mean, with the Muppets in there, I mean, it was so creative, you know.
That's Gina Sedman, founder and CEO of the entertainment magazine, the Indie Post magazine. She interviewed Yarbrough and Peoples in 2023.
You know, she would talk and then he would complete her sentences, which is just like, I mean, it's like your normal everyday married couple that have been married for so, so many years.
The two were first introduced by a piano teacher during the early 1960s in Dallas, and they were married in the 1980s.
They were practically inseparable, playing, singing, and cooking together.
He loved his wife's cornbread. The way it was described, I mean, I can taste it, you know, from just the interview. She said she would take this chicken breast and she would bread it, and he used to love that. That was one of his favorite meals.
To Kevin Yarbrough, thank you for your major contributions to R&B music.
We still won't stop the music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and